heading in to Thanksgiving week. Ladies and gentlemen, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI, right where you need to be. Here on this 25th day of November, welcome to the radio program of record, heard this and every single day of the work week from 6 to 9 a.m. live. And then, of course, we run a highlight show from 5 to 6. Anyway, boy, do we have a lot of things to talk about. Very busy weekend. I'll tell you where I was late last week. As you notice, I wasn't in. Philip J. doing a fine job on Thursday. My good buddy Ari Hoffman on Friday. I'll tell you what that was all about. It's 8 o'clock. We got a lot of other things also that we want to get into this. It's not going to be a slow news week these 3 days before Thanksgiving. Now, normally that is the case. When you get into, you're heading into the holiday season here, Thanksgiving week. This is really the start of it.
Yeah. News outlets, a lot of people start to take their time off. And when the news reporters and news editors start to take time off, that means there's just less news production for us to sort through and figure out what fits into the show.
Yeah, and we just don't have that luxury because there's so many things happening, and they are by and large good things. By and large good things. Now, if you happen to be conservatively inclined, if you happen to be a fan of Donald Trump, you're probably feeling really good about how things have been since Election Day and how he's doing with assembling his cabinet. You know who else feels that way? Most Americans. Brand new poll just out from CBS News is that Donald Trump's incoming administration is starting off on the right foot. A majority of Americans are happy, or at least satisfied, that he won the election and are optimistic, some even excited, about what he's going to do as president. His handling of the transition has got strong approval, and none of his nominees for various cabinet positions, none has more opposition than support. Even including Matt Gaetz, who's no longer in the picture, he had dropped out. He stepped out of the running to be the next attorney general. Pam Bondi, the attorney general of Florida and a former Trump lawyer, has stepped in, and she will be the next attorney general. And yes, she will be confirmed. But let's get into what this poll says, because, again, it just gives you a sense that it's not just strong Trump supporters who are happy right now. It's a clear majority of the American people. Far more people than voted for him are happy with how things are going. And a startling number of Democrats are saying, you know, I don't really feel motivated into complaining. So here are what the numbers say. How do you feel about Donald Trump winning the election? 55% are either happy or satisfied. Only 44% are dissatisfied or angry. 55 to 44. There's your 11 percentage point gap. In other words, in the almost 3 weeks since Donald Trump won this election, America does not seem to have buyer's remorse. America seems to be thinking, yeah, that was a good decision. And we're off on the right foot. When asked how he's handling his transition so far, support grows even more. 59% of Americans, again, this is the CBS News YouGov poll. It was conducted between November 19th and November 22nd, right before the weekend. 59% approve. Only 41% disapprove. So for a guy who got 50% of the popular vote and won a resounding victory, you know, this isn't getting much attention. You know, Trump won 31 of the 50 states.
Based on that, yeah, that makes sense.
31 to 19.
Yeah, you get the Hawaiis and Illinois and the Northeastern New England states.
And the West Coast.
Yeah, and then you get Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and that's about it.
And that's about it.
Oh, Minnesota. Sorry.
Yeah, barely.
Don't want to leave out the Great Lakes state.
Barely. And I even forget the name of the governor there. He was Kamala's running mate. But anyway.
Guy's a knucklehead.
Yes, he's a knucklehead.
Sometimes.
If you don't believe me, you just ask him. Okay, Tim Walz. But I'm looking at this, and this matches how I'm feeling. That I'm just it's good not only that Donald Trump won, but it's good that it was a clear-cut victory. That he won not most of the swing states, he won all of the swing states. That he did better in every single state in the union. Yes, including Washington. That narrative of the first week and a half, Washington's the only state that showed less support for Trump this time than last time. No. It's still a clear majority, strong majority of Washington voters did not like Donald Trump, but it was a smaller majority that didn't like him this year than there was 4 years ago. And besides, by the time Washington state voters, by the time the polls closed in Washington state, this election was over anyway. So the voters also, and this is what I found really interesting, if you're a Republican, you're really motivated to support him. But there are more Democrats who answer the question, does the election of Donald Trump make you now A, motivated to support him, B, motivated to oppose him, C, won't motivate you either way? There are slightly more Democrats who say, I'm not motivated either way, really. I'm not. I'm just done. Only 44% of Democrats say they feel motivated to oppose him. There's just a sense that America has spoken. Again, that's the virtue of Donald Trump winning a clear-cut victory. Not only winning the swing states, not only winning the popular vote, not only winning a majority of the vote, but in addition to all that, bringing in a Republican Senate, not by a bare majority of 50 or 51, but 53. That's going to matter, believe me. And he actually slightly added to the Republican majority in the House. So people are asked, how do you feel about his cabinet? Well, overall, they appear to be pretty satisfied. Marco Rubio for Secretary of State, 44% say, great choice. 25% say awful choice. And about a third say, you know, I just haven't heard enough. What about some of the controversial choices? RFK Jr., Bobby Kennedy Jr. for Health and Human Services. 47% think he's a good choice. 34% think he's not a good choice. 19% say, I want to hear more. What about Pete Hegseth, Secretary of Defense, battling a completely bogus, completely irresponsibly reported bogus sexual assault claim? It is falling apart. It will continue to fall apart. It was, again, just a perfect example of the media trying to report things dramatically out of context from a police report, and make Pete Hegseth look like someone who could have been involved in a sexual assault. You read the complete police report. No, he was not. And the woman who accused him, who did have a fling with him, had that fling while her husband and children were staying at the same hotel. Anyway, what about Pete Hegseth for Secretary of Defense? 33% say good choice. 28% say not a good choice. 39% say I want to hear more. What about Tulsi Gabbard, who was called a Russian asset by, oh, who was it who called called her a Russian asset? It was, oh, my goodness.
A prominent Democrat?
No. It was an anti-Trump Republican.
Oh, okay.
Called her a Russian asset. But most people aren't buying that either. 36% of Americans think she's a good choice. 27% say not a good choice. And 36% say waiting to hear more. Again, that's what you would expect Americans to say, because they, if you don't follow politics closely, you've never heard of Tulsi Gabbard. What about the issues? Now, this is an interesting one. Mass deportation. Again, the media love to use the word mass deportation, or deporting all immigrants in the U.S. illegally. So even with that somewhat loaded language, 57% of Americans approve it. 43% of Americans disapprove. And then asking who should carry it out? Immigration and Border Patrol agencies? Federal law enforcement agencies? The U.S. military? Well, Americans have their civics down pretty well here. 82% say deportation should be carried out by immigration and Border Patrol agencies. Another 64% say federal law enforcement agencies. Only 40% say U.S. military. In other words, you shouldn't need the military for this. We've got plenty of law enforcement within this country. And that's, by the way, that is Tom Homan's position on this as well. Here is Tom Homan, who has said that if sanctuary city mayors or sanctuary state governors try and block federal efforts to deport people in the country illegally, he will slash their federal funding. Here's what he had to say over the weekend talking to Mark Levin.
This administration's turned this world upside down. So now I'm being attacked, right? I got death threats. My family's not even living in my home right now. So all of a sudden, the guys who want to enforce law are the bad guys. The guys who break the law are the victims. And for those mayors and those governors who say they're going to stop me from, stop ICE from doing their job, stop me from doing this job, listen to the Lake and Riley tape. Listen to the 17 minutes of this girl suffering, fighting for her life, fighting for her breath. This little girl didn't want to die. She fought like hell. And listen to that tape. That happens every day across this country at the hands of an illegal alien. And finally, I'll say this. President Trump has made it clear. We're going to prioritize public safety threats and national security threats right out of the gate because they pose the most danger to this country. What governor or mayor doesn't want public safety threats and national security threats out of their neighborhoods, out of their communities? That's your number one responsibility. So you can hate Trump all you want, but you got to love your community more than you hate President Trump.
Oh, man, I love that. Oh, Tom Homan, did Trump just name in a nation of 35-40 million people, did Trump name the perfect person to head this effort? That is Tom Homan. And he's got it exactly right. This mindless anti-Trump, if Trump's for it, I'm going to be against it. This mindless anti-Trump trope has got to stop. You got to start loving your state, and you got to start loving your community more than you hate Trump. He's in another party. So what? He's pushing a policy that you personally don't like. What of it? You don't like it? Run for president. He's elected. You're not. So, looking ahead, this is exactly the spirit that you want to see in this new administration. It is 19 minutes, almost 20 minutes after 6 o'clock in the morning. Philip J. Vandervoort III right around the corner with the morning's first social media sweep on the first day leading into Thanksgiving week. Here, the Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Good morning.
Oh, don't look at me. It's your executive producer thinking we should kind of
I suggested let's get in some winter songs, Christmas songs going.
From the album where Johnny Mathis is actually standing in the snow. Look at that, Phil.
Oh, the pair of skis and poles.
The pair of skis. Yeah, my parents had that album.
Because the ski resorts are open. Crystal, by the way, says they got to close till Friday to kind of work in the snow a little bit. But there you go.
All right. So Snoqualmie is open for skiing?
Not Snoqualmie.
No. Oh. We got Crystal, White Pass.
Okay. Baker.
Mission Ridge, Baker. Whistler has an opening as well. Limited. Check websites before you head up.
There you go. Yeah. All right. Philip J. Vandervoort III, check in with you to see what's going on the social media world.
Well, you know, all the talk for a week has been the windstorm and the power outages, and Puget Sound Energy still has 13,000 customers without power, but they're hoping to get it going here late this morning. The social media sweep, sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. There's been a lot of frustration, do we call it hostility, about the pace of getting the power restored. I'm looking at the Puget Sound Energy outage map, and it's just a couple of blotches now compared to where it was almost all red there, east side of Lake Sammamish. And certainly other parts east of Lake Washington. So the Hobart area around Tahoma Elementary School is one of the ones I'm looking at. Miramont in between Hobart and Issaquah is another area that's got a pretty wide swath of people without power. The East Renton Highlands, another area near that.
But out of context.
Southeast of Cougar Mountain Regional Park. Pine Lake Park.
Okay, then, because out of context, we had 620,000 households without power last Tuesday.
At the peak of it,
And now we have 13,000.
13,000 for Puget Sound Energy. I think Snohomish PUD has a couple thousand or maybe just under 2,000.
All right, let's hope that those final 1,000 are taken care of.
So Puget Sound Energy had tweeted out on Friday that they were updating the restoration times in three, time periods. They had said Saturday at 12 p.m. they'd have some power restored, Sunday last night at 6 o'clock, and then this last batch is supposed to be on by 10 o'clock this morning.
Talking to Phil,
too. So that's
the
time they're working around.
Talking to Phil, too, among some of the personnel working. 13 different trucks, utility trucks, were damaged as they were taking care of the trees and the power lines.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that slowed it down in some neighborhoods.
Yes.
I mean, people are wondering, hey, is there anything more the Inslee administration could have done? But when you've got a governor who's not interested in using fossil fuels, it's sort of difficult to get chainsaws to work on electricity alone.
And
sometimes
backup,
gas-powered chainsaws are more effective.
The social media moment brought to you by the Heckle Generator Company. Oh. Make sure you have a generator at your home.
The backups in all these neighborhoods, like Maple Valley, miles, traffic lights out. People have to drive for miles to get groceries and get gas because you couldn't get it there in your neighborhood.
I mean, maybe the remedy is if the power's out in Miramont or Hobart or the Sammamish Plateau, Pine Lake area or Issaquah, something like that. Maybe the power needs to be out at the governor's mansion until it comes on for everybody else. I don't know. Is that a reasonable, unreasonable thing to suggest? Here's one person in Redmond who posted about some of the frustration and the power outages that were ongoing through the end of last week. I'm at the bottom of Education Hill next to Anderson Park. Guessing that's why I don't have power. I'm pretty understanding of the difficulties facing Puget Sound Energy. Just wish there was a better way to get an estimate of when I'll get my power back.
You know what they did?
That's a more constructive complaint rather than just the out-and-out hostile ones.
They actually did something pretty smart at Puget Sound Energy. They said last week, last Thursday, we hope that people will have their power back by sometime Saturday. And, of course, people going,
that was,
Saturday?
Yeah, that was the initial.
And then for tens, hundreds of thousands, boom, the lights were on that very afternoon. That's what happened to us.
Sure.
We got a notice on Wednesday afternoon. Oh, we'll try and get the power back by Saturday. And the power came up. On Wednesday evening.
Yeah.
So what do you say? Boom. Yeah.
Now, Pam Bondi is
One o'clock in the morning on Thursday. That was it.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Right. Yeah. So a little over 24 hours, 30-odd hours maybe. Pam Bondi, of course, is now the newest attorney general nominee for Donald Trump after Matt Gaetz withdrew his nomination. And on Wikipedia, where users can go ahead and alter the information and update information on these biographical encyclopedia-like websites or entries for individual people and historical events and things like that. Pam Bondi's got changed around to say Bondi is a brown noser that has kissed Donald Trump's ass enough for him to appoint her Attorney General of the United States. Now, that's not how Wikipedia is supposed to operate. So somebody had
noticed
this.
Is that really in Wikipedia?
That was somebody. Some hooligan, some vandal, basically edited it that way. And then somebody's conservative that I follow on social media pointed out Wikipedia is an information warfare cesspool, Trump's new AG pick. And this is her page right now, what I just read you. Even if this is resolved in a few days, the next 24 hours are when people might be pulling up the Wikipedia file for Pam Bondi and seeing this. And then it turns out that this was changed within about 1 minute. But this is the upside and the downside of Wikipedia. Knuckleheads can get in there and alter something like this and be a jerk about it. And I'm being as very polite as I can in mixed company here.
Sure.
But it was rectified after 1 minute.
You are listening to The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Bill Maher talking to the very popular scientist TV star, Neil Tyson deGrasse, really shows him up as being why people have declining respect for American institutions. You're going to want to hear this right around the corner of the Commute with Carlson.
Remember this tradition?
It's about a 90-minute song, if I recall correctly.
Alice Brock, who created that from an eatery there, inspired Arlo Guthrie for the 18-minute classic for Thanksgiving. Alice's restaurant passed away. Word got out on Facebook on Friday.
Oh. Now, wait, who passed away?
The creator, Alice Brock, who inspired Arlo Guthrie to create this song because of the eatery. And
I thought you said Arlo Guthrie.
No. Yeah, Alice Brock. A lot of hits online, Spotify, everybody's loading up this song, 18-minute classic. It's a Thanksgiving hit. Making points with your listeners, John, playing this.
All right.
There you go.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist, best-selling author, science commentator, impeccable credentials, is kind of what Carl Sagan used to be in the 80s. It is to a much more a greater extent what Bill Nye the Science Guy. Bill Nye the Science Guy was there, you know, doing a science show for kids. Neil deGrasse Tyson is, you know, not someone with a mechanical engineering degree. He's a real scientist. But he's also woke. What does that mean? It means that he often pulls his punches when he's talking about the left or talking about issues where the left has intense positions. One example of that that came up on Bill Maher's very popular HBO show is whether or not women don't do as well as men in sports, not because they're not men, but because of discrimination. This is the kind of thing that drives Bill Maher up the drives him over the edge, because he says this is why Democrats lose when there is this active attempt to boycott common sense. And so here he is on Bill Maher's show. He was invited guest. Maher's not a scientist, but watch him take down this scientist over an issue in the science world. This was Friday night. Start with Bill Maher.
This is in Scientific American.
Yeah.
Less than a year ago.
Scientific American magazine.
Inequity between male and female athletes is a result not of inherent biological differences between the sexes, but of biases in how they are treated in sports. That's nuts. And it sure ain't scientific, and it's in Scientific American. And that's why the Democrats lost the election. It's true.
Bill, every 20 minutes on your platform, you come up with another reason why the Democrats lost. No. You already have the answer. They lost the election. So anything you say
that's
is why
true.
They did it.
First of all, you don't watch this show, so you don't know that. I know you don't, and it's okay. But you talk as if you do, and you up. And that's okay. Just don't bull me. That's the one thing people can't ever do on your show is bull me. And that's fine. But I don't say that. I have very good reasons. But engage with the idea here. What I'm asking is, Scientific American is saying, basically, that the reason why an NBA, WNBA team can't beat the Lakers is because of societal bias.
What you're saying is not Scientific American says that. An editor for Scientific American says that, who no longer has the job. So don't indict a 170-year-old magazine because somebody
American, and they're printing something
because someone enters the cesspool that is social media and then participates in that exchange.
Why can't you just say this is not scientific and Scientific American should do better?
Well, does she still have her job?
No. Not because of this. I said the scandal is not her tweet.
Because that was like a year ago, was it? Which one was a year ago?
I think a year ago women still couldn't beat men in basketball or any other sport. And it wasn't because of society. You don't see a problem.
By the way,
here.
Long distance swimming, women might actually have the advantage. You can look into that. Yeah.
Maybe long distance swimming. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. I've looked into it. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to file you under part of the problem.
Okay. First of all, good for Bill Maher. But second, look at what Neil deGrasse Tyson didn't do during this entire exchange. Neil deGrasse Tyson didn't say, yeah, that's silly to argue that. He actually gave a far-fetched example of an instance where maybe not always there could be cases where women have the advantage, like in long distance swimming.
So one out of maybe 1,000 sports.
Yeah. So and I don't even know if that's true, but notice that he didn't want to say what, and Bill Maher was pressing him on it. Why won't you just say it? Women aren't as good as men in sports because men have a biological advantage. Why can't this Harvard-educated astrophysicist, why can't he just say it? This is why, Bill Maher's correct, this is why Americans are just turning their backs on all these institutions and all these people who claim to speak. I speak for science, Anthony Fauci. I am science. When you disagree with me, you're arguing with science. No, he's thoroughly politicized. And so is Neil deGrasse Tyson. He did not want to say, look, Bill, people in my profession, they've got to stop conflating social goals, societal goals with actual science. And yes, that does happen from time to time. It happened too often with Scientific American magazine, which Tyson's correct. It's been around longer. It's the longest continually published magazine in the United States. And, you know, it came under the control of a very woke editor. And she ended up losing her job. Her name is Laura Helmuth. She ended up getting bounced because after Donald Trump won the election, she sent out a series of tweets saying, F you to Trump supporters, and apologizing to young people because my generation, she's Gen X, too young to be a boomer, my Gen X is so full of effing fascists. That's the editor-in-chief of Scientific American magazine. And so she was bounced for that last week, and I mentioned that on the show. But what Bill Maher was talking about, so, under her leadership, Scientific American published an article that insinuated that science has shown that men do not have a biological edge over women when it comes to competitive sports, that it's because of societal bias that men have an advantage, which is not science at all. It's nonsense. It's preposterous. But that was that magazine under Laura Helmuth. And Neil deGrasse Tyson said, well, she doesn't have the job anymore. And Maher said, not because of this. She lost her job last week. This article was last year. But this is the direction she took that magazine. You know, the best-selling author and the founder of Prager University, Dennis Prager, also does a radio show. He once said the left, the political left, not liberals, not Democrats in general, not liberals, but the political left ruins everything they touch. And this was a perfect example. She was actively ruining a cornerstone of science and culture in the United States, the magazine Scientific American. And of course, the magazine was having trouble even before with woke ideology, before she got the job. That's why she got the job, is because she was woke. But she lasted 4.5 years. She got bounced. But again, the big takeaway here, and I'm so glad that Bill Maher nailed Tyson for it, Neil deGrasse Tyson for it, is that he knows it's BS. He won't dispute. He won't argue otherwise. He won't argue, no, Scientific American, they had it right. No, he won't argue that. But he also won't say, no, you're right, it is silly. They shouldn't have said it. That's why the left wins when respected, quote, leaders, which presupposes they have a backbone, when leaders refuse to state the obvious because it might cause a kerfuffle among the progressives. They might be angry. They'll send out mean tweets. I'm so glad America turned its back on that culture on November 5th. Our buddy, Lars Larson, our new to three host, right around the corner on the commute with Carlson this morning, Talk Radio 570 KVI. All right, not too many people out on their Harleys and Indian motorcycles today. Not the best weather for two-wheeling.
Not in the Evergreen State, anyway.
Not in Washington State. Here's a nice and interesting email from KVI listener Emery. Emery is from Puyallup. Says, greetings, John. My wife, a Democrat, is still getting daily Democratic Party emails begging for money. The logo is no longer Harris Waltz for president. Now it's Harris Fight Fund. At first, the appeal was for money to contest too close to call races. Now that those races are behind us, the new line is, it might not seem like $50 will make the difference, but if everyone reading this email pitches in what they can, we'll be able to go toe-to-toe with Donald Trump every step of the way and show him what he's up against. Close. Oh, who would fall for that? Who would fall for that? Anyway, Emery concludes, even though Democrats lost the election in large measure because they were not truthful, they are still not honest enough to admit to their own donors that they need this money to pay off their campaign debt, which is exactly what it really is all about. They had $1.5 billion. And they finished $20 million in debt. I don't think it's because they were fighting Donald Trump toe-to-toe. I think a lot of consultants were making out good on that system. It's 4 minutes to 7 o'clock on the commute with Carlson. Hour number two right around the corner. Oh, man, I don't think this has hit the news wires just yet. Hunter Biden is furious. He went down to the White House. He had been told that the president was going to be pardoning a couple of turkeys today, and he just assumed that he was one of them. So imagine how disappointed he was.
I'm waiting for all the videos on social media that people have been playing with here during this election year.
So now he's going to be able to pivot a little bit and say, well, if you are pardoning those turkeys, what about me? So here's my prediction.
A little less than 2 months.
Joe Biden will not be pardoning Hunter Biden, but Donald Trump will. I think Donald Trump, just as kind of a gesture of bringing everyone together, of goodwill, I think Donald Trump's going to pardon Hunter Biden. And you know what? I don't have a problem with it. You know why? Because I think the reason Hunter Biden got, landed with this prison sentence was because he was Joe Biden's son. Now, other people are going to say, well, he would have been in trouble sooner if he wasn't Joe Biden's son. Yeah, for the crack and all the other stuff.
Basically lying about the felony on the gun possession, gun permit or gun purchase form, right?
But in all honesty, that should be charged a lot more than it is, but it rarely is. And I think the reason they went after it the way they did so doggedly was because he was Joe Biden's son. So
Democrats made their bet on that a little bit, too, because they want to be tough on
guns. They want to be tough
stuff,
on guns,
right?
Especially.
We got to have gun control.
They said, look, we have a choice. Get tough on guns or get tough on criminals. Well, that's easy. We're going to get tough on guns.
Yeah. Well, with all the fight and rhetoric and all that we saw in the election campaigns here, kill them with kindness. Kill them with kindness will always take the win.
So anyway, let us pivot, as I was saying, from national to local. Did you hear what happened over the weekend?
Series of DUI crashes?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm not even talking, you know, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I'm talking late Saturday night into the wee hours of Sunday morning.
It seems to be about a 4-hour window.
One, two, three, four. Speaking of four, four Washington State Patrol cars were heavily damaged by three suspected impaired drivers. Again, it all happened within a 4-hour time span beginning late Saturday night, about 11 o'clock. Trooper was stopped at a traffic light at Highway 516 and Military Road in Kent. That is a big intersection. The trooper noticed a driver sleeping at the stoplight. The car with the sleeping driver began to roll into the intersection. The trooper moved his vehicle in front to stop it.
Yeah, to kind of shield it from possibly being hit by a crossing vehicle.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
In other words, the trooper basically put his cruiser into the path of the rolling vehicle to keep other vehicles from being struck and people from being hurt. The driver arrested for suspected impairment. Okay, now that police car was slightly damaged. The other crashes, a little more serious. Sunday, two troopers at the scene of a hit and run on I-5 near the Boeing Access Road in Tukwila. While they were at the scene, a car crashed into one of the troopers' vehicles, which pushed it into the other State Patrol cruiser. The driver arrested for suspected impairment. So now we're up to three. Then the fourth vehicle was hit while headed to help with traffic control. As the trooper approached the scene, another driver struck the State Patrol vehicle. That driver also arrested for suspected impairment. Four State Patrol vehicles damaged within 4 hours. John Batiste, the State Patrol chief, says driving after or while consuming alcohol, drugs is a terrible choice. It can cost you your life or someone else's. We need you to buckle up, slow down, and move over for your troopers and first responders. Okay. So, you know, he's saying, you know, quote, let's give ourselves a chance to appreciate and responsibly celebrate the holidays with loved ones and friends, close quote. Okay. Very nice. But I've got an idea. I heavily suspect that one or more of these four drivers, or of these three drivers, one or more of these three drivers probably has more than one DUI on their record. I really doubt that all three of these drivers have first time ever. So someone please explain to me why attempts to make a third DUI, not a second, but a third DUI, a felony charge, why it always comes up short. And you're thinking, well, wait, John, I don't recall the legislature holding hearings on this. No, you're absolutely right. They don't hold hearings because they don't want to publicize the fact that Washington continues to allow people convicted of a third DUI. You have three DUIs on your record. Again, that's on your record. It's not how many times you've been driven drunk. It's how many convictions you have for drunk driving. And yet you're still not in felony land. This is the same problem we have with people who are convicted of stealing firearms or people who are repeatedly caught illegally possessing a handgun. We don't throw the book at them, and then we wonder why we have so much, quote, gun violence, close quote. How do you think criminals get their guns? They either steal them or buy them or get them from someone who has. It's the same problem we have with drunk driving. Why is Washington State among the nation's leaders now, among the nation's leaders in highway deaths? Why did we set a 30-year high record last year, which exceeded the previous year's 30-year high? It is because, well, the anti-police chase law had a lot to do with that, because the anti-police chase law simply made the roads not less dangerous, more dangerous. More dangerous people on the roads, more dangerous drivers. But alcohol had a lot to do with it as well. And Washington just refuses to get tough on drunk driving. I don't know. I don't understand why we keep giving breaks to people that we've already given breaks to previously, and they thumb their nose at us. And, you know, this isn't about forgiving sin, which, you know, the Bible tells us, forgive others as you are asking God to forgive you when you sin. We're not talking about sin. We're not talking about just sin. We are talking about criminal conduct, which you get a break when you commit a crime for the first time. You usually get a break. But we are giving breaks to people who are convicted over and over and over again. And are we surprised that while crime nationally is going down, it's going up here in Washington State? That violent crime is going down, but it's going up here in Washington State? That we are now among the nation's leaders in auto theft because, here we go again, you've got to be convicted like six times of stealing. Six times convicted now. Not arrested for, six times convicted of auto theft before you're looking at felony charges. Why? For people who can't afford to buy a home, the most expensive thing they possess is their vehicle. It's their lifeline to the economy, how they get to work, most of them, how they get their family here and there. And yet when someone steals that car, basically Washington State's attitude is to shrug its shoulders. Not good.
John, the other big thing on this too, and I know we have a lot of police law enforcement to listen. I go back to Valentine's Day of this year when we got word out of Spokane. From January 1 to the 14th of February, State Patrol had 1,321 drivers impaired. As you're sharing about the DUI, people are wondering, how can we find people that are getting pulled over in the morning at 7:30 on a commute or at 10 o'clock, you know, in the morning or whatever? The key is impaired. I'm saying it's not all alcohol-related. Washington State, we do have marijuana that's legal. And if you talk to anybody, you know, who uses marijuana, whatever, and you go into the cannabis shops, and again, cannabis owners, nothing against you, but some of them have said some of the stuff is so potent, most people can't handle it. And I'd be curious, and again, law enforcement, I know you can't share, but every time we have an impaired driver pull over, it's never defined. Was it alcohol? Was it marijuana? Or was it medicine? Or whatever. And that's the frustration of all this.
Here is your answer.
Okay.
A growing proportion of impaired driving is drugged driving. The reason why that proportion is growing is that drugs were, for all intents and purposes, legalized, at least as far as the street was concerned. When you remove criminal penalties or made the criminal penalties next to impossible to enforce, which the legislature did on purpose, you made drugs, hard drugs, legal. So it's not just marijuana. It's people who are driving on meth, people who are driving under the influence of fentanyl. The problem with marijuana is, you know, when we hear marijuana, we think marijuana the way it was when we were teenagers. It's not like that anymore. There used to be a movie. There was a movie made 90 years ago, back in the 30s, called Reefer Madness, where, you know, it shows somebody getting addicted to marijuana, a young couple getting addicted, and they end up becoming zombies, practically. I'm exaggerating to make a point, but that was the movie. And they used to screen this movie in the 60s and 70s as a way of mocking and laughing at how America comically overreacted with scare tactics to marijuana use, smoking a joint. Okay, that movie what matches the reality of marijuana today. They used to say, oh, you can't get addicted to marijuana. You can now, and you can't suffer brain damage from marijuana. You can now. Marijuana is a terrible drug, precisely because so many people think it's harmless or borderline harmless. Oh, it's just like having a beer.
Well, I can
not anymore.
I can tell you, I don't partake in marijuana, but I have several friends that do and do on a regular basis, and they hold down, I think, what we would probably all agree are kind of solid, if not upper level jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I think so much of it comes back to the individual person, individual personality. And certainly if you over consume anything, it can be devastating for a person. It could be cheeseburgers.
Yeah.
It could be contraband. But maybe I just hang out with a different level of people that are able to compartmentalize all of this and still take care of all their day-to-day duties, and they pay their mortgage, and they show up to their job on time, and they take care of all those personal decisions.
Yeah, I mean,
and they don't fall into the traps of just intoxicating yourself for the sake of intoxicating yourself.
I'll give you a more famous example is Rick Steves. Rick Steves cheerfully admits that he, you know, fires up a joint every now and then. And that is, yes, there are some people who can hold their drug habit.
Yeah.
But when you hear people play down the significance of drugs, understand and make the case for legalization, understand that if you think drunk driving is a problem, add to it marijuana and heroin and meth and party drugs like ecstasy. Add to it all these things, and that is why the streets are so dangerous.
So many wrong way drivers.
All right. Yeah, that comes up. And one other caveat to all of this, particularly as it pertains to marijuana, it is not something for teenagers to get involved with and experiment with. That is just a bad combination right there. Consenting adults.
7:20 on the commute with Carlson Talk Radio 570 KVI. Philip J. Vandenberg III, right around with the social media sweep. You are listening to the commute with Carlson. Again, 7:21 in the morning. Speaking of which, good morning to you. Decades. I got the title of this song wrong.
We all do, Joe.
Now, what did Gordon Lightfoot just say? He just said, "Is every highway."
Exactly.
But no, he was really saying, because he was being Canadian and not pronouncing his English words correctly.
Okay.
Carefree highway.
Yeah. Highway songs in mind with everybody's travels, average of 50 miles or more for Thanksgiving.
All these decades, I thought it was every highway. No, carefree.
Yeah, yeah. There's a whole page on misidentified lyrics from people over the years. Pretty funny to see.
But I was going to notify Gordon Lightfoot about this, and he had to go and die on me, so now it's too late. Anyway, Philip J. Vandenberg III, not too late for the social media sweep.
Never. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. We're a couple of days away from Thanksgiving, and there are a lot of stories going around about, hey, you know, inflation. It's dropping down a little bit. Those prices are improving. And then the national news media outlets are sharing the story that says, hey, the cost of your Thanksgiving meal is going to be lower this year than it was last year. But not in Washington state, no.
Uh-oh.
The Seattle Times has posted a story, and it says, the cost of Thanksgiving groceries in our region has increased, bucking trends seen throughout other parts of the country based on new pricing. So tip of the hat to Jay Inslee on that one. Thanks for keeping the cost of transporting goods to market high. All of those other things that are associated with transportation and the incredibly high price of gasoline here in the state of Washington. Of course, you can't forget that grocery stores need to have extra security now because you have shoplifters that go in and swipe whatever they can get their hands on and bolt out of the store. And all those costs get passed along to customers. And that's why the cost of your Thanksgiving meal in Washington will be higher than the national average. Tip of the hat, Jay Inslee. Travis Couture is a Washington State Republican representative from Mason County.
Yes.
And he has picked up on this story that's been developing here for the last week or so. We've talked about it at different times on your show, John. And this is a $10 to maybe $12 billion projected budget deficit for the state of Washington. And Governor Inslee having to acknowledge this and asking parts of his cabinet to come up with possible budget cuts. And then, of course, possible tax increases that could remedy this projected $10 to $12 billion budget deficit.
Absolutely no one else to blame but he and his own party.
The majority Democrats in the legislature that do the budgeting. So Travis Couture is the Republican state rep. He posted, I was looking through the office of Governor's Inslee's proposed budget cuts for next year as a state stares down this massive deficit. One cut is to Results Washington, which is supposed to be all about accountability, transparency, data-driven approaches, and continuous improvement. A second cut was to Special Education Ombudsman that assists special needs students and families. Couture sums it up saying, I find it funny and sad that all the things made the spending cut list by Inslee. I suppose it's on brand for the governor. Under-resourced special ed families and want to walk away from accountability initiatives.
Yeah, no, it's let's cut these things. It'll cause a huge controversy, and so we can use that as the platform to lobby for tax increases. Well, we don't want to cut these poor people off from these desperately needed programs, so we'll have to raise taxes. We'll need the revenue.
Yeah. Final one. This is from We Heart Seattle. Andrea Suarez, she was a candidate for state legislature in the city of Seattle, the legislative district in the city of Seattle, Capitol Hill area. She runs We Heart Seattle. She ended up losing that election, but she posted, our We Heart Seattle truck was vandalized with the word fascist scribbled on one of our QR codes for how people can snap a picture with their phone. The QR code immediately takes them to a web page for more information. When did picking up trash and helping addicts off the street to treatment lead to this hatred? Why? She writes. And I would say add this one.
Perfect.
To,
perfect question.
Yeah.
Yes.
Add this one to the bullying of the vandals that attacked the University of Washington president's house here a week or so ago.
Cowardly bullies.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. This is the fascist name calling and bullying that we've come to expect from the progressives, the enlightened progressives on the political left in Seattle.
You're listening to the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. When we come back, a surprising result in a statewide ballot measure in California. First time we've seen anything like this in more than 30 years. I'll tell you what it is in just a couple of un momentos. So here's an interesting story. You know, this there were so many interesting things that happened on Election Day that were completely obscured by the drama of Donald Trump winning a surprising victory in terms of the breadth of his victory, not just in terms of the Electoral College, which was 312 to 226, or the number of states he won, 31 to 19, or he won all the swing states, he won the popular vote, he actually won a majority of the vote, especially when you pare it down to just two candidates for president rather than the, I don't know, there were about a dozen different names on our ballot. And so it's easy to, with a crowded ballot, U.S. Senate, governor's races in several states, state legislative, Congress, everything going on, to miss the significance of some other things that happened. Now, Philip J. Vandervoort III, more than anybody else, has his radar, political radar, sharply attuned to the minimum wage issue. Anytime he sees
really bothers
a
me.
Story with a minimum wage angle, he's on it. And he makes it a regular part of social media.
Yeah, it shows usually people's failure of understanding basic economics.
So, maybe somebody sent out Milton Friedman, copies of Milton Friedman's book, Capitalism and Freedom, or Free to Choose, but California.
Yeah.
Became the first state in America to reject a statewide minimum wage increase in three decades. Californians voted down Proposition 32 to increase the minimum wage from $16 an hour to $18 an hour. It's the first time in California history that voters rejected a statewide minimum wage increase at the ballot. The proposition failed. About 51% of the voters said no. 49% said yes. Organizations like the California Chamber of Commerce, the California Restaurant Association, the California Grocers, they all opposed the measure, said it would hurt small businesses, family-owned grocers. It would increase prices for Californians. It would jeopardize funding for public safety and education. The state, or excuse me, the National Federation of Independent Businesses California State Chapter said that voters, quote, correctly saw Proposition 32 to raise the minimum wage as another broadside on the ever-shrinking budgets of working class families. It would have immediately raised the minimum wage for any business with 26 or more workers to $17 an hour. And then in a couple of months, it would raise it again to $18 an hour. That would be a national high. There are roughly 40 California cities and counties already with minimum wages higher than the current statewide rate of $16 an hour. So that's my take on this. Why do we have a statewide minimum wage when we have such a very different state where you have, you know, you can get a house for $200,000 in several, you know, Eastern Washington.
Yeah. I was thinking Eastern Washington locations. Yeah.
Towns. Yeah. And hamlets. But you can't get anything less than 600,000 or maybe 500,000 here in Seattle.
Yeah, you'd be on the outskirts of even the exurbs to do that.
And yeah, in King County, you're way, way the heck out there if you want. So my point being that you have very different economies of scale.
Yeah. And the thing that bothers me the most right now about the minimum wage stuff is that there was a time and a place for minimum wage. We used to have a really difficult time traveling from place to place 100 years ago. Mobility was not nearly as easy and economical as it is now. And if you're in an economically depressed area and you cannot make a living and you don't have job prospects, your ability to go somewhere else where there are those prospects is so much easier now. And any of the minimum wage stuff, that can be negotiated between the employee and the employer. And if someone's got previous experience working a job and they think they're worth more than 10, 15, 18 bucks an hour, they can prove that to the employer. And if you're a teenager who's just trying to get that first job, and I felt this way long before I had a 16-year-old, but I have a 16-year-old now. He's got his first job. He's getting 19 bucks an hour.
What?
And he just got a $60 bonus. So he's at Arena Sports.
Good for him.
So this is like the indoor soccer center. And he does the classes with the youngsters. He leads the classes with the youngsters. And a bunch of the kids that were in the existing class he's teaching renewed for another session. And I didn't know that this was part of the equation, but he got a $60 bonus because many of the kids signed up for another class.
Well done, Austin.
Yeah.
Very nice.
So, I said, the minimum wage just becomes a barrier for younger kids to possibly get a job. Because who's going to pay a kid that has no experience $20 an hour?
So
nobody in their right mind that runs a business is going to do that.
The guiding force behind this California, a blue state, a state that voted for Kamala Harris by double digits, but interestingly, less Kamala Harris, the former senator from California, got less of the statewide vote in California than Joe Biden did 4 years ago. Think about that one. Favorite daughter, Kamala Harris, gets less of the vote than Joe Biden. And California voters repealed a law that was actually set by initiative about 8 or 9 years ago that stated that if you shoplift less than $950 worth of merchandise, you can only be charged with a misdemeanor. And of course, given the logic of the criminal justice system, well, if it's nonviolent and it's a misdemeanor, we'll just put that in the back of the line in terms of a priority. And we're inclined to lower the, you know, plea this out, maybe even just dismiss the charges. So you had an explosion in shoplifting and you had organized retail theft gangs that were, again, looking for a great opportunity, you know, the spend the least amount of time and effort to get the most amount of return on your dollar. And they thought, well, shoplifting is the way to go. So it not only hurt California businesses, it helped popularize a trend that we see up here in Washington. Organized shoplifting rings. So they did away. They struck down that law in California. And then they vote down a higher minimum wage. California looks like it is ever so incrementally swinging back toward the right.
Well, hopefully they're seeing the mistakes that were made with the prior policy decisions.
Let me be as precise as possible. They're swinging rightward toward the center.
Yeah.
Okay, they're still not there, but here's a couple of really great indicators that they're at least moving in the right direction.
Well, that's my big gripe about Democrats is they can never deliver what they promise. You know, they promise, hey, $15 minimum wage, that's going to make everything more affordable for people to live close to where they work. And what are we doing now in King County? Guillermo Zahile, King County Councilman, is going to propose like $1 billion subsidized housing plan that will require more tax money so that, quote unquote, people can live closer to where they work. But wait, I thought the $15 minimum wage was supposed to save all that stuff. And then you got the crime and punishment stuff that they can't deliver what they promise as well.
It is Boeing time on the John Carlson Show, 747, the commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Well, this is interesting. The Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, admitting he was wrong about a top of mind front burner issue that we just were in the middle of a huge debate over in this country. Find out what it is and what position he is now taking on this issue right around the corner as the commute with Carlson continues. Talk Radio 570 KVI. It's 53 minutes after 7 o'clock, 7 minutes to 8 o'clock. On the commute with Carlson. I thought you were going to play some Neil Young here since we're talking about Canada.
Yeah, it's another Canadian band called the Sheepdogs, a little bit more contemporary, but they've kind of got that 70s sound to their music.
Well, we knew that Canada would start, you know, moving a little bit rightward on some issues, let's say crime, but who ever thought that they would admit that they were completely wrong about immigration. And I'm not even talking about illegal immigration. Have a listen. This is the uber liberal Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau.
Immigration. Let's talk about it. In the last 2 years.
He said, immigration. Let's talk about it. Okay, in the last 2 years,
our population has grown really fast, like baby boom fast. And increasingly, bad actors like fake colleges and big chain corporations have been exploiting our immigration system for their own interests. So we're doing something major. We're reducing the numbers of immigrants that will come to Canada for the next 3 years. Today, I'm going to let you in on what happened, where we made some mistakes, and why we're taking this big turn.
Yeah, blame it on corporations, will you? No. Canada was all in, like Europe, and like the Biden administration, was all in on welcoming huge new swaths of people into Canada. And then the problems started. Again, we're not even talking about illegal immigration. The Biden administration wanted both legal and illegal immigration. It has become such a headache for Justin Trudeau that they're not just freezing the number of illegals. They're actually taking fewer. They're cutting the number of people they will allow to legally enter Canada and they're beefing up their efforts at removing illegal aliens as well. Well, that's interesting. It tells you where, it's not just America, where much of the West is going finally. Finally regaining a sense of sovereignty and responsibility. When we come back, where was I the last couple of days of last week? Well, I will explain it, and you won't want to miss it. It's coming right up after your 8 o'clock. My goodness sakes, it's time for hour number three of the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI, Monday edition of the Thanksgiving week, the Commute with Carlson. And we are looking forward to Thanksgiving. We're already hearing the stories of people traveling.
Yeah, traction required right now, white pass, chains for big rigs. Otherwise, we're clear, bare and wet, Snoqualmie, I-90. Highway 2 is not doing bad. Traction advised there. Yeah, last normal weekend we just had, John. Now it's all holiday-type stuff for
all
the rest of the year.
All holiday stuff for the rest of the year. So, speaking of Thanksgiving, we'll be doing it at our house this year.
Oh, I thought you said we're working.
No. No, we get...
Thanks.
Well, you get Thanksgiving dinner off. We'll need you here though for dessert.
I miss my times in small market radio, Eastern Washington, the South Sound. I'd always work Thanksgiving Day, and people in the community would stop by and knock on the door and actually bring me a Thanksgiving dinner and dessert to the radio station.
Oh, nice.
Some of you still know. I thank you for that when I was 17 and trying to get my way back to Seattle.
So we'll be doing Thanksgiving at the Carlsons. Sometimes we've alternated. We've done it at my younger brother Bill's house. He and his wife Roberta have a lovely, beautiful Thanksgiving table that they set up. But for well over 50 years, Thanksgiving was always at Mom's, and Mom was in charge. And it wasn't until, you know, about 5 years ago where she reluctantly but firmly decided to relinquish Thanksgiving honors to the other, the younger generation, if you will. This year at the Carlsons, there will be an empty chair at the Thanksgiving table, and that will be the chair that Mom used to occupy.
So sorry, John.
Mom died on Friday morning.
Oh, wow.
And it was something that I was actually expecting to happen sometime within the next year, because Mom had made it clear. She was telling me this 2-3 years ago. She was saying, you know, I've had a very full life, and I'm ready to go at any time. And then, come to find out, she had made out her last will and testament, and she had arranged for her remains to be, looked after and all of those arrangements had been made. And then, you know, her health began to slip a little bit, but steadily. And she had a stroke a few years ago and needed to use a walker, and her eyesight was failing. And then in early November, we had to admit her to the hospital. She had a little bit of pneumonia, and it was good that they caught it quickly, but they also said, you know, at your age, mom was 90, getting close to 91.
Good for her.
Your lungs are in pretty rough shape. And so when the power went out at her place, she lived in the Spirit Ridge neighborhood of Bellevue. My younger brother Bill came and picked her up because they have power up at Everett, and she was with him. And I got a text on Thursday from Bill, and he said, "Hey, we've got a problem. Mom had a very tough night, and she had to be taken by ambulance to Providence Everett. And I got a text 23 minutes before the show started on Thursday morning. So I was, raring to go. We had a show, set up and ready. Phil and I had already talked about what we were going to be discussing. And a text came in from Bill, said, "You should probably come up here, bro. Mom needs us here. She wants to go. But we need to stabilize her to get her home so she doesn't pass in a hospital." And Bill's married to a critical care nurse who was very distraught at her situation. And he sent another text as I was driving up to the hospital. Said, "We're going to admit her to the critical care floor until we can get the power, until we can get her power back on in Bellevue and get her home with some comfort care." Well, a whole lot changed between the time that text came in and the next 24 hours. First of all, huge thanks to Phil, because calling in sick is one thing. Being here and notifying your producer that you have to leave the show 23 minutes before it starts, that's a real challenge. And Phil didn't blink. He said, "Nope, you got to go. Something like this, you got to go." Never have I had to do this in all my years on radio. That goes back to the early 1990s. So, Phil, many thanks for stepping in the way you did.
No problem. I knew what you were telling me. You needed to go be with family.
And, of course, with the power out all over the place, and we were giving all these alerts about what's open, what's closed, where you can drive, where you can't, at least you had an ongoing, story to help fill in the gaps there. But I went to the hospital, and mom was in one of the ER rooms they put, directly behind the trauma center. And she had one of these masks on that was giving her oxygen, but also filtering, trying to get rid of the fluid that was in her lungs. And she said, it was hard to understand her with the mask on. She says, "It's time to go. It's time to go." And eventually, they were able to move her up to the ICU and were able to replace the heavy mask they had on her with kind of a light touch with just oxygen breathing tubes. And that's when mom told us the way it was going to be.
Still in charge, son.
And mom said, "I'm ready to go." And we said, "Well, mom, we understand that. And you know, we have to make sure your condition stabilizes, and then we can bring you home. And she had thought about that and said, no, right here. And she made it clear that it wouldn't be for several, it wasn't, you know, she wasn't intending to stay several days in the hospitals. She was ready. And she made her intentions very clear, and she asked to see the grandkids. And somehow we got all the grandkids there, either live or by live stream.
Right on.
And everybody said their goodbyes to her. And she indicated that she would like the breathing apparatus that was giving her fresh oxygen to be removed. And we were welcome to be there with her. And of course we were. And we waited. And she basically just wanted nature and God to take his course. And she passed away early the next morning, like in the middle of the night. The nursing staff were so wonderful. I want to single out two nurses in particular. Stephanie, who goes by the name Steph at Everett Providence, and Ben, who was the night nurse, they were so wonderful and so compassionate and caring. And Stephanie actually, I mean, she only looked after mom for several hours, but they, and mom had a way of doing this, they developed a relationship, an attachment. And before she left, she said, I just have to come in and give you a hug. And then they arranged, there is a gentleman who has a classical guitar, and he goes from room to room in the critical care unit playing classical guitar music to help, you know, set a peaceful, serene mood. And he did that. And the people there at Everett Providence really could not have done more or done better. They were just wonderful. And mom made note of the fact that she was not going to be at the Thanksgiving table this year, but she said, please make sure you have Thanksgiving. Very important holiday for mom. And so we will. And we will also be, you know, saluting our mom, our matriarch, who was so wonderful. Are we sad? Of course. Are we distraught? No. No, not at all. A couple of months ago, mom and I, we made kind of a weekend ritual of, I would come over and watch either Mariners games or the Seahawks games. And we were talking about how much longer she had. And I said, oh, mom, you've got a couple of years left at least. And she said, oh, I don't even know if I'll be here by Thanksgiving. And that was a month before she passed away. So
I always seem to know, John. And just I'm just throwing it out there because
seem to know.
You're so close to her. And, you know, God bless you here for having a mom to age 90. I lost mine when I was 23. And but at Thanksgiving, I'm sure a lot of listeners, Phil, you'll go on this, I would still set a chair for your mom at the table, and I'm going to say one word, watch.
You know, she is, she's where she wants to be.
and she's where she deserves to be. And recently I was reading 2 Corinthians, the New Testament, and chapter 5, verse 6 says, "So we are always confident, knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord, for we walk by faith, not by sight. We are confident, yes, well pleased, that we will eventually be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord." That is where she is. And that is why we are so happy that she passed so peacefully, that she lived within a week of her 91st birthday. She would be 91 this Friday. And, of course, KVI listeners will remember all those years we did the toy drive at the Fred Meyer, and Mom, as long as she could drive, which was until she was 88 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
She would drive to the Fred Meyer from Bellevue to Issaquah, and she would walk into the store, and she would come out with several hundred dollars worth of toys, and she would always say the same thing. "Well, I don't have to shop for you kids anymore, so I think I'll help shop for someone else's." And, you know, that's Mom. Just so, so much love that she shared, and which came back, recycled back to her from others. Whether it was in her work, or whether it was at home, or whether it was with friends, faith, family, friends, all very important to Mom.
And you talk to her every day now. I never heard, what was her name, first name?
Pat.
Pat?
Pat, Patricia Lancey.
Patricia.
Patricia.
I never knew that.
But that's how most people knew her, just as Pat. So that's where I was Thursday and Friday. And yes, we will set that chair for Mom at the table on Thursday. It is 21 minutes after 8 o'clock. You're listening, of course, to the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Philip J. Vandervoort III, right around the corner's favorite segment of the day, social media from socialists on The Commute with Carlson. And we return to our regularly scheduled programming. Ladies and gentlemen, Philip J. Vandervoort III's favorite segment, social media from socialists on The Commute this morning. What do we got?
All right. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. Claire McCaskill's a pretty much a regular on MSNBC. Yeah. Former U.S. Senator from, is it Missouri?
Yeah.
Does that sound right? Senator from Missouri. Claire McCaskill posted this in her torpor and ennui about the outcome of the presidential election, and I guess probably some of the congressional ones too. And maybe for Senate. She posted, "For years, as I watched fictional movies and TV shows about government, the military, our justice system, I have always reassured family and friends that would never happen. I am no longer confident of that, and, well, that really, really sucks." So, like I said, there's a little bit more of the myopia from the political left.
Oh, boy.
Ari Hoffman, you know, he's been such a tremendous watchdog of King County government.
And Seattle. Yeah. Yes, both.
Mm-hmm. So Ari was trying to get questions and answers last week based on the windstorm damage and the fact that King County Regional Homelessness Housing Authority didn't really make any sort of concerted effort to try and get homeless people off the street and inside to some sort of at least temporary shelter in the day or two around the heart of last week's windstorm. And so
it's interesting because they do when there's snow in the forecast.
Exactly. If it's cold, if there is wildfire smoke, We've got to get people indoors. Windstorm? Eh. So Ari started asking these questions. And Ari was posting about the what he felt were the lack of answers he was getting from King County Regional Homelessness Authority. And one of their responses was, our current severe weather policy addresses cold weather and precipitation, heat in the summer, and wildfire smoke. On Tuesday, before the windstorm, we sent out tips for how to stay safe during the windstorm with a link to shelters in the area. So that's basically what the Regional Homelessness Authority did. And then people started picking up on Ari's complaints on the political left. And one gal posted, this guy who spent his entire public career demonizing unsheltered people is now concerned that he suddenly cares about them with the windstorm. And so that was one kind of reliable lefty. And then someone retweeted that comment and what Ari had gotten as far as a response from the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. And this person is a candidate who tried to run for Seattle City Council and failed in the primary, never got very far, but is a usual pretty reliable left-wing progressive and posted some agreement.
Is it Crookshanks?
No.
Robert Crookshanks?
I'd have to double-check this person's name based on when they ran for city council. But at any rate, this person posted some agreement with Ari saying, Ari Hoffman is a piece of bleep, but he's absolutely bleeping right. King County Regional Homelessness Authority has been an unmitigated disaster, and the only thing stopping progressives from making this critique is their slavish dedication to defending any and all forms of government. So like you were talking about with California an hour ago.
Oh, yeah.
Here's a political progressive in Seattle that can see that the King County Regional Homelessness Authority has been a total debacle boondoggle.
Well, it's between those who will say, okay, what is government for? What is it supposed to be doing in this instance? Versus those who think that the existence of the program itself is the purpose.
Yeah.
So that's why you have people who continue to support welfare programs that only intensify poverty and make dependency more entrenched rather than helping to free people or help people free themselves would be the better way of doing it from poverty.
So there's KVI's afternoon host, Ari Hoffman, bringing progressives over to his side.
It is coming up on 8:30, the Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. CBS News poll find most Americans seem to be pretty happy with how Donald Trump is handling his transition, and they're feeling pretty good about the election as well. That and some vocabulary changes on the way from the Trump administration. I'll explain what that is all about as the commute continues. It's 8:30. It's 36 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning on the John Carlson Show. PSE still trying to get that final. They had 620,000 homes without power as of last Tuesday night, and they're down to their, I think, their last 10,000. It was 13,000 when we went on the air.
Yeah.
And got another 3,000.
During the course of your show, they've restored about 3,000. One of the spots is Westlake Sammamish Parkway, and then another spot out near Hobart. But Miramont, there, in between Issaquah, Hobart, is still without power, and the Pine Lake part of the Sammamish Plateau. Those are kind of the two biggest areas they're working to try and restore still.
Thank you to everybody with the long hours, all these utility personnel, and all the ones that came from other counties
and other states.
Yeah, yeah. They brought my nephew home from, I just tell him, Phil, he's stationed down near the California border. He said, oh, you got to get up north, got to help out there in Seattle.
How about that? Right. So when it comes to politics, words matter. The terminology you use, the vocabulary you use, the labels that you use. And when Joe Biden took office, one of the first decisions he made was to stop using the term illegal alien when it came to discussing illegal immigration. In April of 2021, the senior official from the Biden administration performing the duties of Border Patrol commissioner told the agency's personnel, 60,000 strong, stop using the term illegal alien. Stop using the term alien. Stop using the term assimilation. Employees were instead told to start using the term non-citizen or migrant. So, in other words, take out any reference to illegal activity. They're just non-citizens or they're just migrants. Also, if they did have to mention status of their non-citizenship or the status of their being a migrant, they were to substitute the word undocumented for illegal. And in terms of talking about assimilating or assimilation, they were to use the term integration. In January of that year, 2021, ardently liberal Congressman Joaquin Castro. He's a Democrat from a very liberal district in Texas. Yes, they do have them there. Introduced the Correcting Hurtful and Alienating Names in Government Expression Act. To prohibit the government from using the term alien, because he said it is derogatory. Fellow Texas Democrat Henry Cuellar said, quote, I can understand some people are trying to be a little more politically correct, but if you look at what the statutes say, they do use the word alien. That's what the statute does. So until that statute changes, some of us will continue using the word alien. That is the word in the statute until we change that. Well, that was then. This is now. Advisors to Donald Trump's transition team on Homeland Security have told reporters that discussions are underway to reverse the Biden administration's politically correct language when it comes to immigration. Quote, expect all of that to change, close quote. Another official involved in advising transition officials confirmed that talks on returning the term illegal alien were true. That I don't see anyone at Immigration and Customs Enforcement or Border Protection using any euphemisms for illegal aliens after January 20th. A retired field director for ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, who might be the next leader of ICE, his name is John Frabicatore, said he hadn't heard of this, but he certainly supports it. Quote, what is wrong with the term illegal alien? It connotes no race, no religion or culture. It is purely a legal term that was hijacked in an Orwellian attempt to control the messaging about illegal immigration. So, you know, how many times have I played this over the years, Phil? When Bill Clinton was giving his State of the Union address in the mid-90s.
Just like maybe 96 or something like that?
It was 95 or 96. he talked about illegal immigrants and the problems that were posed by illegal immigration. And again, he didn't hesitate to use the term illegal alien.
Yeah, I've got a few seconds of that. You want to hear some of it from, it was from 95, State of the Union.
And he went on to explain why they were a problem. And basically, everything that Donald Trump complained about in 2016, Bill Clinton was complaining about in 1995. And everything that Donald Trump says he's going to fix are problems that needed fixing back in 1995. Bill Clinton didn't always follow through with his rhetoric. I do know that this is one issue where Donald Trump likely is, in part because of his director of all things border, including deportation. Here is Tom Homan, who is a veteran of both the Border Patrol and ICE, worked his way up through the ranks to run ICE. And was brought out of retirement by Donald Trump to fix the border. Here he is over the weekend on the Mark Levin Show.
This administration's turned this world upside down. So now, I'm being attacked, right? I got death threats. My family's not even living in my home right now. So all of a sudden, the guys who want to enforce the law are the bad guys. The guys who break the law are the victims. And for those mayors and those governors who say they're going to stop me from, stop ICE from doing their job, stop me from doing this job, listen to the Lake and Riley tape. Listen to the 17 minutes of this girl suffering, fighting for her life, fighting for her breath. This little girl didn't want to die. She fought like hell. And listen to that tape. That happens every day across this country at the hands of an illegal alien. And finally, I'll say this. President Trump has made it clear. We're going to prioritize public safety threats and national security threats right out of the gate because they pose the most danger to this country. What governor or mayor doesn't want public safety threats and national security threats out of their neighborhoods, out of their communities? That's your number one responsibility. So you can hate Trump all you want, but you got to love your community more than you hate President Trump.
Oh, I'm so glad this guy's in charge. I mean, this is the perfect, perfect guy to have in charge. And by the way, the American people seem to agree. Brand new CBS poll. Brand new, just out over the weekend. Do you support Donald Trump's vow to deport all immigrants in this country illegally? Do you support Donald Trump starting a program to deport all immigrants in this country legally? Approve 57%. Disapprove just 43%. Not only that, people seem to be pretty pleased with the general flow of things since Donald Trump won. Again, this is the CBS YouGov poll conducted late last week, released over the weekend. How do you feel about Donald Trump winning? 55% of Americans are satisfied or happy. Only 44% of Americans are dissatisfied or angry. When it comes to how you feel about the election of Donald Trump makes you now A, motivated to support him, B, motivated to oppose him, or C, won't motivate you either way. It's very interesting. 44% of Democrats say they're motivated to oppose him. But 46% say they're not motivated either way. In other words, nah, it's just, you know, the election's over. So nowhere near the intense opposition and the Trump derangement syndrome spilling out all over that we saw in 2016. So again, you have most Americans, in fact, a much larger majority than those that voted for him. Donald Trump had the support of 50% of the voters, the popular vote, first time he's won the popular vote. But 55% of Americans are happy, satisfied about him winning. Only 44% feel the other way. 59% approve his handling of the presidential transition. 59%, only 41% disapprove. You're listening to the John Carlson Show this Monday of Thanksgiving. 7 minutes to 9 o'clock on the John Carlson Show. Earlier this hour, I announced to listeners the reason I was gone the last couple of days last week. Mom passed away. And I had no idea when Thursday started that she was going to, but her health took a turn for the worse. We were with her in the hospital throughout Thursday. She passed away early Friday. And some wonderful comments from listeners. Ed in Tacoma, John, my condolences on the passing of your mom. Your mom will celebrate Thanksgiving in heaven. Murph in Gig Harbor, John, your story reminds me of when my mother passed at 93. She was ready to go. She was independent and losing that. The last thing she said was, life's good. See you on the other side. She smiled and passed peacefully on her own terms. Bless you and your family. Karen in Everett, John, my heart is with you. I just lost my 100-year-old mom on October 3rd. Her health suddenly failed. I took her in the hospital on a Monday night, and she passed away in my arms. So sorry. Oh, I'm sorry too, Karen. But so nice that you had her in your life all those years. John in Linwood, I'm so very thankful for your mom's life. Art in Issaquah and Stilgar in Snohomish County, Richard, Virginia. I'm getting texts from listeners all over. They're so, so wonderful, and I am so, so grateful. I have the best listeners anywhere. Best staff, best team, and best listeners. It's why I love doing this. And would love to hear from you anytime. You can text your thoughts, 206-421-5757. Get out there. Enjoy this day. Let's talk again tomorrow.